Hello, everybody, and welcome to Science Studio again. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about the atmosphere. What is the atmosphere? Well, of course, we breathe it every day, but there are things in there other than, say, oxygen and nitrogen. There's dust, and there's all sorts of pollutants, perhaps, and perhaps we ought to know more about what's up there. And so, in fact, there are departments who do nothing but study atmospherics and what is in the atmosphere. And so today we're going to have as our guest Kevin Perry. He's a professor from the College of Mines in Utah in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences. And Kevin, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
How did you become an atmospheric scientist? I mean, that's a conglomeration of all sorts of backgrounds, a little physics, a little chemistry. When did it all begin? It
began for me at a really young age. So, for example, I grew up in Kansas, and we have lots of thunderstorms. And I absolutely was mesmerized by lightning and gust fronts that would come out from these thunderstorms, where you could feel the wind pick up and the temperature drop, you know, 10 or 15 degrees in just a matter of minutes. And it just absolutely mesmerized me. And I had to argue with my parents because I always wanted to be outside to actually experience it. And they didn't want me to do that. So we made a compromise where I would sit in the garage with the garage door open so I could still feel the elements, but be safe on the inside. And that sparked a lifelong interest in studying, learning more about the atmosphere and how nature can produce things that are so powerful.
Did your parents come up with sort of scary stories of little boys being blown away and never seen again? So, you know, be careful and all the rest of it.
No, it was mostly just lightning. It was about that time that we had a lightning storm, and the lightning bolt hit the transformer behind our house. And it shook the entire house and made a wonderful fireworks display as the transformer was sparking. Yeah. And I thought this was great fun until I realized that we weren't going to have electricity for the next week. And we had to camp in the house, basically, because...
What time of the year was this?
This was the spring sort of thing.
Okay, so that was the best time of the year.
Yeah, exactly.
Not too hot, not too cold.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And a slight adventure.
Yeah, exactly, sort of thing.
So did you then decide when you went through high school and go to college that atmospherics or something like that was going to be your major?
Actually, I was fascinated with science at a young age. The atmosphere, obviously, geology actually had my interest, but the schooling was not great. Nobody encouraged me in science. And so I basically left science behind for years and years. And it wasn't until I actually started going to university where I tried to figure out what it was that I wanted to do. I thought I was going to be a lawyer. My wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, was saying, you really need to do something that you love. You know, and law was not going to be that sort of thing. Ironically, she turned out to be a lawyer. But
And the marriage survived.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, good.
She's an environmental lawyer, so that's good. So we tried to figure out what I could do that would combine my skills. So I thought, I loved the weather. I love talking. Why don't I, plan on being a weatherman on TV? And that's what that was what my plan was.
All right.
And then I went to the university and did an internship at a local TV station and said, this has to be the worst job in the world. I think I need to rethink this.
What was bad about it from your point of view at that age?
It was...
Repetition.
It was the simple fact that they didn't care about the quality of your forecast. They only cared about the ratings.
All right. And so you had to be entertaining.
Yes, you had to be entertaining.
Right.
And it didn't help that the person that I was doing the internship for was very sour on the profession sort of thing.
Okay. So then what did you study in university?
I studied atmospheric science. I stuck with the atmospheric science.
Where?
At the Iowa State University.
Okay. Ames, Iowa.
It was the closest atmospheric science program to where I grew up at the time. Oh. And it had this affiliation with the ABC TV station, which I thought would be a great combo.
Right.
I was studying atmospheric science and, decided to end up going to graduate school at the time.
I mean, what do most people – we don't have an atmospheric sciences program here at UT El Paso. But, I mean, if you get a degree in that, what do people usually do? Don't tell me they go on the radio or television.
Well, most people think of atmospheric scientists, and what do they think of? They think of as TV – they think of military, they think of National Weather Service, and then they think, oh, there's research stuff too. But that's really just the tip of the iceberg because there are so many industries that require detailed information. You think about agriculture, you think about natural gas industry. They all need information about the weather, and the airline industries, they all actually employ their own meteorologists
to
do the in-house forecasting.
Okay, so farming is, of course, one that comes to mind now. That is really highly technical.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, they've got sensors in the soil for moisture, the temperatures and all the rest of it. And it's really made farming much, much more efficient. Right? And then do you have any role in that yourself?
No, it's actually interesting because, I started off as an atmospheric scientist, enthralled with the weather. And eventually I turned my sights to air quality issues and I really don't even follow the weather anymore. Yeah, I don't use that aspect of my background in either my personal or private life. It's mostly just focusing on air quality issues now.
Where did your PhD come from?
University of Washington.
Okay.
And I was doing the interaction of clouds and pollution.
In Seattle?
In Seattle, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So very different from the plains of Iowa State.
Yeah, it was extremely eye-opening. I loved the diversity that wasn't present in the Midwestern United States.
Right.
It opened up my ideas to, oh my gosh, there's actually a fish called a salmon that you can eat.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. It was really bad.
Well, if they'd gone the other way, what would they have discovered? Corn?
Corn and beef.
Beef. Oh,
every meal starts with beef in Kansas, anyway.
Okay. So there you are. You went away. You got your PhD in meteorology in atmospheric sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sort of made it your business to worry about the quality of the air.
Yeah, that was actually kind of happenstance. I was studying, cloud microphysics and how clouds interact with their environment. And I realized I'm never going to get a job in that.
Unless you become a professor.
Yeah, exactly. But the physics of what's going on with the particles, with the cloud droplets is actually very similar to the physics that goes on with particles in the atmosphere. And so I started learning about more chemistry, taking more chemistry classes. And so I ended up doing a postdoc at UC Davis with Crocker Nuclear Laboratory, learning about how to analyze particles in the atmosphere using nuclear techniques. And we were actually working on a contract from the National Park Service and then basically doing the air quality analysis for the national parks in the United States. And that was a fascinating job.
You know, we were talking a little bit before the program about how weather forecasting, as opposed to the big climate issue, but weather forecasting has become quite accurate. I mean, for me as an Englishman, I mean, the weather forecast in Britain when I was growing up was always partly cloudy with showers. I mean, it was everything you could want or not want, right? But here, when I came and I just could see the satellite images, you could see that you could predict days ahead, but now they're beginning to be able to do it for hours ahead quite normally.
Yeah, as the computer power has increased, it's allowed us to create more sophisticated models that have better resolution so we can actually get down to the neighborhood level on what the forecast is actually going to be, which is quite an improvement over what it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Okay, so in a nutshell, what's the quality of the air in the United States? Obviously, it's a curate's egg. Some places it's great, other it's not so good. But has there been, I think the general perception is over the last 20, 30 years, it's been improving more or less everywhere.
Yeah, that is true. There are certainly pressures that are threatening that improvement over time. One of those big issues in the West is the increase in the frequency and severity of wildfires. That have significant impacts on air quality. If you think about the controls that are on emissions from industry, the regulation that's been involved in that, that's been a steady improvement. If you think about the efficiencies of the automobiles and the increase in the electric fleet, the zero emission vehicles, all of that is moving towards a cleaner environment. And I've done a lot of research on air quality. I've been to China 7 times to study air quality issues there. But the air quality in China was absolutely atrocious. And the people there had just kind of accepted that that was the way it was and not realizing that that's not the way it has to be.
I watch Formula One races, mm-hmm. and I've seen them from China. I've seen them from India, where and cricket matches from India and Delhi. Well, you can't see from one side of the ground to the other, really.
Yeah, the first time I flew to China, there were no clouds, and you're flying along at your cruising altitude, and you can't see the ground because of the pollution.
Yeah.
I landed, and you couldn't see the end of the runway because of the pollution. And
but the trouble with that is that the pilot couldn't either.
I took my first filter measurement that I usually take in the United States, and the filter clogged after 12 hours because there was so much particulate matter in the air.
We'll come back to that later, yeah. Because the whole notion of the atmosphere, it's just not what's the atmosphere in Utah or what's the atmosphere in Texas or in El Paso. It's a global issue. I mean, I remember we've done a science studio program many years ago with people that were talking about particles of dust that were coming over from China that had certain bacteria on them that we don't normally find here. And then they find them in Houston, right, in used tires, a little bit of rainwater that was residual. It's an international problem.
Yeah, when I was working for the National Park Service at UC Davis and looking at the data from the national parks in the United States, one of the parks that kind of was pretty interesting was Big Bend, Texas. And the reason was is because there was a whole bunch of dust that was happening in Big Bend, Texas in July, in a time period when you don't have, you know, the really strong winds that kick up the local dust. And we were looking at the chemical composition of it, and it was unlike anything that we'd seen elsewhere in North America. And when we started looking at this, this dust signature existed all over the eastern half of the United States. And we were actually able to trace it back to having origins in Africa. During the summer, that dust is coming all the way across the Atlantic and up into the southeastern United States. And there's more dust in Texas in July from Africa than there is from North American sources.
That's interesting. And there's nothing you can do about that because that's just the nature of the way the weather systems operate.
Yes, the state of Florida was concerned about air quality issues, and they were violating the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, and they wanted to get excluded for the Saharan dust because there wasn't anything that they could do about it.
And what happened to that plea?
It was shot down because it was still impacting people's health, and they said, well, you need to work harder on the things you can control.
Wow, that's fascinating, Kevin. Really, really is so. I mean, that's one of the problems with government, of course. People say, well, they make you do things or warrant that you have to do them when you can't do anything about it. But we'll come back to that also. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break here. You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Kevin Perry from the Utah School of Mines, Department of Atmospheric Sciences. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Professor Kevin Perry from the Utah School of Mines. Talking about atmosphere, talking about dust, talking about dust flying all over the world. It started in Africa, you know, dusty part of Africa, and lands up in Big Bend, Texas. Not many people in Big Bend, Texas, so you can't say it's a big health issue, but obviously it went everywhere else too.
Right.
Why was it that you were looking in Big Bend, Texas, as opposed to an urban area, which it might have some impact on people's health?
All of the air quality sites that were being funded by the National Park Service were in the national parks. So they were in these rural areas.
Oh, I see.
And they have later expanded the network to include urban areas. But at the time I was doing it, that data just didn't exist.
So if you were to go where you are now in Utah, into the national parks there, did this dust from Africa get that far? At some stage, that westward flow has got to meet the predominant westward flow so that there's got to be a line somewhere down the middle.
So that's true, and it's the Rocky Mountains primarily. So you're impacted by the eastern flow. Basically, you have the eastern half of the United States is impacted by the Saharan dust. In the western part of the United States, we're impacted by Asian dust that comes across in the westerlies. We see that quite commonly in the springtime. It will deposit on the snowpack and change the reflectivity of the snow. But that Asian dust actually makes it across the Rockies and into the eastern United States. And my colleague here at UTEP, Tom Gill, has pictures of African dust of Asian dust that was transported across the Rockies here into Texas and impacting the visibility locally as well.
So we understand that there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
what on earth can we do about it other than say, well, we recognize that it exists. And I suppose if there's an outbreak of some disease in Asia or Africa, we should think, be a little more careful because some of these materials can be dust-borne. But beyond that, it's just a fact of life.
It's not just a fact of life because the dust that's being generated is not purely a natural phenomenon. It is also being impacted by irrigation practices and by land use.
Okay.
That is exacerbating the problem.
And
in
industrial
these
use too. So right. In fact, mm-hmm. since the source is extra USA,
right.
then that calls for a sort of big diplomatic worldwide agreement upon how you treat your land.
Yeah, but we also have local issues and regional issues as well in that, you know, we have lots of dust sources that are more local that have stronger impacts. You know, you have sources around here that when they blow, it severely impacts the air quality locally as well. And those are, you know, your local and regional sources, which we do have more control over.
Yeah, in fact, I just was reading, and maybe you see it was a BBC website or something, how the eastern states of the United States are sort of hollering that, well, we're net importers of pollution from the rest because of the westerly flow. And so they have an interest in what goes on in Ohio, for example.
Right.
And coal burning. All of these things are part of what you deal with on a daily basis.
Right. And talking about the choices that we make have impacts. You know, where I live in Salt Lake City, you know, we live right next to the Great Salt Lake. And water diversions are being done at such a level that the lake is actually shrinking. And it's exposed more than 750 square miles of lake bed adjacent to a population of 2 million people. And those people are now being exposed to frequent dust storms that are coming off of what used to be the bottom of the lake, which has now been exposed.
When was it a lake? Has it ever been since immigrants came from Europe and crossed over the U.S.? Was it ever a lake covering that whole size? Or
yes, as recently as 1983, it was covering the entire area that it could, basically.
For part of the year?
Yeah, at that time, it was, you know, covering it for the entire year, basically. It goes through an annual cycle where we get snow melt, which raises the level of the lake, and then we have evaporation during the summer. But that's we only lose about 2 feet of the lake to evaporation each year, and the snowpack will either, you know, replenish beyond that 2 feet or not replenish, depending upon whether it's a good snow year.
Yeah, but I remember the Bluebird and other cars that were always sent to the Salt Lake Flats to try to beat the land world record.
That's a separate area.
That's another area.
So 13,000 years ago, there was a large lake called Lake Bonneville that covered about one-third of Utah, part of Nevada. And as that Lake Bonneville dried up, as the climate changed from, you know, coming out of the last ice age, it left salt deposits on places that are now completely desiccated without water. And you have these salt flats. But the Great Salt Lake is the remnant of Lake Bonneville. It's, you know, six times saltier than the ocean. And it's, you know, rather small, you know, but it changes. It's very shallow. I think the deepest part of it is about 20 feet.
Okay. So now when you get these dust storms that whip up the dust in Utah and Salt Lake, what are you finding that's in this dust that's not something that's therapeutic?
Right. So the dust itself, regardless of whether or not there's anything that's toxic in it, when you put particles into this atmosphere, the particles have an impact upon your lung function. They can lead to strokes. They can lead to cardiovascular disease, gastrointestinal problems. The list just keeps going on and on as we learn more and more about particles. And that's regardless of whether or not there's anything in there that's toxic. And so I was actually funded to do a study to determine if there were any heavy metals in the soil sediments that we need to be concerned about. And I spent basically 2 years going out to the lake and collecting soil samples and bringing them back to the lab and you know, drying them, sieving them, resuspending them to find out what the chemical composition of the size of the particles that we actually breathe is.
And what did you find in terms of heavy metals?
The element that we were most concerned about is arsenic. It seems to be naturally high in the rocks and the sediments in the region. because every single measurement that we took, even the ones that are furthest away from any industrial processes, were elevated over concentrations that the EPA would like to see.
Let's go back to that issue that you just alluded to, that is the size. The smaller you get, the greater the surface area, right, compared to the total substance.
Right.
Does that have an impact upon the amount of metals that can get absorbed or not? Is it just, from the point of view of metals being absorbed, is just surface area, period, and size doesn't make a big difference?
I think it has a lot to do with the specific mineralogy and whether or not it would be something that could be absorbed by the body, at the pH of the body fluids. And that's not an area that I've spent a lot of time working on, but it's something that we need to look at. You know, we have these high arsenic concentrations, but is the arsenic in a form that can actually be absorbed by the body if people are exposed to it or not?
The speciation, as we call it, right?
Yeah.
And so do you work in a collaborative team to pass on this information to people in the health area, or?
Yeah, pretty much. That's, the model that I've used is, getting other people on the team that have expertise beyond your own sort of thing to
Where the Utah government or Salt Lake City, I mean, who is it that funds this apart from the national park?
Ironically, I got my funding from two sources. One was the Department of Natural Resources that was concerned about exposure to the dust. But Utah actually also decided to build a prison right on the shore of the Great Salt Lake between a large tailings pile and the lake. And they were concerned about, whether or not they might get sued in the future by inmates who are exposed to the dust or from the tailings pile. And they wanted to know if there was anything that was unique or uniquely dangerous about the location that they had chosen to build the prison.
And what was the conclusion?
The conclusion was that there's nothing unique about that particular site, that everybody in the Salt Lake Valley would be exposed to the same materials. And so they went ahead and purchased the property and are in the process of building it now.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, the argument would go, if it was, they'd have to put the prison right next to the state capitol. All right. Then the people creating the law and the people mm-hmm. breaking the law would be together.
Right.
And they are quite often sometimes.
Right.
Okay. So this is good. So now, how do you collect your samples? I've heard these apocryphal stories of Professor Perry cycling all over the Great Salt Lake.
So I'm an atmospheric scientist, and the way an atmospheric scientist would normally do this is we would set up equipment on the edge of the lake and wait for a dust storm to happen and then make sure that you have all your equipment running so that you can sample the dust when it comes off the lake. I wanted to make sure that I could get dust samples, and I wasn't very patient. So rather than set up shop on the shore, I decided to go out and collect the samples myself. And so the lake bed itself is expansive, 750 square miles. And if you take a heavy vehicle out there, like an ATV, it gets stuck and sinks. So that's really not much of an option. So you can't walk because it's too far. So I decided to do it by bicycle. And so you put a fat tire bike with a trailer behind it, and you set up a grid system, a coordinate system, and you go out and you collect soil samples. And I had a preconceived idea that it would be very uniform out there, and it couldn't be further from the truth. It was very heterogeneous.
What are you talking about, uniformity? The content of the salt?
I just mean the visual terrain sort of thing.
Okay, right.
And so I set up this grid system, a GPS coordinate system, so that I wouldn't have bias in how I was collecting the samples. And basically collected samples every 500 meters over the entire 750 square miles over a period of 2 years. I had to took about 150 trips out to the lake. Each day, you end up bicycling about 20 miles, and it's a full day of sampling.
And did your graduate students go with you on this?
Ironically, because the money came from the prison, they didn't. They actually stipulated that no students were to be involved in the program because they were concerned that if they were sued, that they didn't want to have students that would testify, only professors. So the money came with a stipulation of no student involvement, so I had to do it myself.
Just Perry and his bicycle.
Perry and my bicycle.
Did you have to buy a special bicycle from the grant
in order to do this? I had to buy two bicycles because the salt was so corrosive it destroyed the first one.
Presumably you, well, maybe, did you ever go with somebody else to take a visual photograph, your wife or something?
No. I've had a lot of publicity, once I finished sort of thing.
I've taken people back out.
But not when I was doing it myself sort of thing.
Okay, and so there was a lot of arsenic in that region also. I mean, the arsenic is distributed quite widely.
Yeah, it's distributed over the entire lake bed. But I didn't know that when I started, obviously, sort of thing. Only after when I got it back to the laboratory and analyzed it.
Anyway, so you are single-handedly responsible for the fact there's going to be a prison in a place which is not too egregious in terms of its dust and its health hazards.
Mm-hmm.
What's your next project? That's a temporary project. You've got to get it done in your two-year period.
Mm-hmm.
What is really setting your light right now?
Right now, I've learned so much about what was out there and what the dust sources were like, but it just literally scratched the surface of trying to understand the ecosystem. And I've actually become an advocate for trying to save the Great Salt Lake ecosystem. If you think about the great terminal basin lakes of the world, the Aral Sea comes to mind. It was completely desiccated. The ecosystem was destroyed. You had Owens Dry Lake in California, which, we use the word dry to describe it because it doesn't exist anymore. And the Great Salt Lake is traveling down the same path. The water diversion is so extreme that the lake itself is drying up, and we know what's going to happen if we don't do something to ensure the water gets into the lake.
So that gets you into the realms of policy, politics, and faculty are notoriously uncomfortable in those environments.
Absolutely.
But you've got that in your sights, and so good luck with it.
As I've gotten older, I get more and more focused on regional issues that have impacts on people. And so trying to use my knowledge to help that out.
That's speaking like a good scientist. Get your training first, get your expertise, and then begin to use it to impact policy, perhaps, if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the condition of human life. Kevin Perry, thank you very much for being here on Science Studio. We've run out of time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And Sam Cassiano, thank you for putting it together. Make sure you edit all those pieces out that shouldn't be there. And we will see everybody again next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.